Welcome to an Eastern Standard special series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU, Democracy Optimist, with Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law and author of The Court Versus the Voters, The Troubling Story of How the Supreme Court Has Undermined Voting Rights, publishing in May. Throughout the 2024 election season, considered by many to be the most consequential of a lifetime, we'll be bringing you conversations with election and voting experts from across the political spectrum so that when you go to the polls on November 5th, you'll arrive fully informed about how it all works to keep our democracy alive and well. Missed an episode? No problem. You can find a growing list of episodes online at esweku.org. Just click on the Democracy Optimist tab. So let's dive right in. Here's Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. Today, we are speaking with Secretary Jocelyn Benson, the Michigan Secretary of State. She's in charge of elections in this critical swing state. She was once a law professor of voting rights as well as a law school dean, and she quite literally wrote the book on the vital role of secretaries of state before becoming one. Secretary Benson, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
So you were the Secretary of State during the 2020 election, a pretty controversial time, and you were quite busy, obviously. What was the most challenging part of being the head election official in Michigan in 2020?
I think the most challenging part was to really stand at the forefront of seeing all the misinformation and the manipulation and the lies that were part of the strategy to retain political power and in some cases raise money and, create celebrity for some people as they try to gain that and sort of become renowned figures by challenging the election results. But it's really both heartbreaking, but also a reminder of what the anti-democracy playbook is. And we've seen it in various different forms throughout our country's history, and it's never fully gone away. And it manifested itself quite poignantly in 2020 through the misinformation and lies that then transformed into threats and harassment and people showing up outside my home, outside counting boards where people were counting votes in Detroit, people showing up outside our state capitol. And of course, the tragedy, it all culminated in the tragedy at our U.S. Capitol on January 6th.
Yeah. And so do you think as you're preparing, things are going to get better or things are going to get worse?
We have a number of adages on our team. One of them is hope for the best and plan for every contingency. So we just remind ourselves of that. Another one is try to take a challenge and make it an opportunity and never lose the opportunity that a crisis provides to really create some good change. And so we look at everything through that lens. How do we use what we're enduring to make us stronger, to make our democracy stronger? And how do we plan for every possible contingency in 24, knowing that we've already seen the tactics that folks have been willing to deploy in 2020, and that we need to expect that they'll be revisited again, perhaps with new seasons and flavoring, but certainly, with the same goal of if someone doesn't like the election results in this particular election, trying to block them from coming to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, I often tell people that just because you lost an election doesn't mean the election was illegitimate. The right response to losing an election is to fight for the next one and try to convince the voters of your cause. One of the points of this show is to explain to everyday voters how elections actually work. So let's dive into that a little bit. What is Election Day itself for the early voting period and then, the Tuesday in November? What does it actually look like for you?
Well, obviously, there's a whole bunch of stuff, months of preparation that goes into play. But on election day itself, the morning begins with, we sort of track it based on, what could go wrong and what is happening and what's their inflection point. The beginning is the opening of the polling places all throughout the state. The opening bell rings and we hope everyone's in their places. We have actually contingency plans of 100 people on standby if people don't show up to polling places so that we can make sure every place opens on on time, and we continue to push for that goal and have met it in the past several cycles. And then the morning is usually a little slow. I'll visit a number of sites and talk with people. And after that first rush, things can sort of hit a bit of a lull until maybe the afternoon. We'll see more people coming in at lunch. Then for me, I'm going around the state all day, hitting different media markets, visiting different precincts and polling sites, talking to election workers, seeing how things are. And every 2 hours, my team is meeting with media to let them know what they're seeing and help provide content, good stories of all the positive things that are happening, and respond to any misinformation or questions that may have emerged in the sort of that recent span of time. And then on the opposing hours, so on even hours, we're having conversations with the media. On odd hours, we're having conversations with folks in the field, grassroots organization, League of Women Voters, others who are nonpartisan but have an interest in making sure democracy goes smoothly. The 188 Your Vote group, our vote, you know, that gets a lot of hotline calls. Then we check in with them to see what they're hearing and respond to things they may have questions about. So it's constant stream of communication. And then the other layer we have on top of all that, in addition to my visits, in addition to those calls, is a field team in place all throughout the state, so that at any given point, we have someone who is connected to my team within 5 to 10 minutes of any polling site. So if we hear of anything or something pops on social media, we can physically get there to see what needs to happen and work with the clerks and poll workers on the ground to either address something or dispel a myth that may have been getting out of control.
So you literally have people throughout the entire state within, you said, mm-hmm. 5 or 10 minutes of every polling site to be able to get to the place right away if it sounds like there's something going on, or if there's, you know, rumors about what's happening. Obviously, a lot of logistics involved in that. So let's talk about the myth-busting role of your job, which, you know, maybe wasn't something you thought was going to be part of the job when you ran. What's the biggest myth that many people believe about how our elections operate, and how do you combat that misinformation?
I think the biggest myth is the lack of transparency, and we combat it with more transparency. We have become even more transparent, holding open town halls. Our local clerks have always done testing of election equipment before every election, but we're making sure everyone knows about that. Post-election audits have also been something that we have prioritized and really amplified in a sort of exponential way over the last few years, so that there's as much sunlight on the process as well. And we welcome the questions posed in good faith of people saying, you know, why did this happen? Or why are you only allowed to have, you know, one person from each party observing a particular polling site, or different things like that? We welcome those questions and we counter any misinformation with the truth. But, you know, the biggest challenge is that it's oftentimes these aspersions that something's going on behind closed doors, that some decision is being made or votes are being counted in the absence of sunlight, when in reality, we have, you know, full sunlight on everything we do. But it really underscores our need as officials, public officials, election officials, to be as transparent as possible in the work that we do to help restore and ensure people have faith in the process.
That's great. That's kind of the point of this whole, you know, radio segment as well, right? Casting a light, shining a light on the way our elections operate, so people believe in democracy and believe that democracy can be sustained in 2024 despite all of the challenges that we face. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I think Michigan is doing that is through a bunch of pro-voter laws that were passed and signed into law over the past year. Walk us through some of the changes to Michigan election law, and especially those that will help voters.
Well, we've had two rounds of ballot initiatives in 2018 and in 2022 that collectively have really transformed democracy in our state, amending our state constitution to, among other things, implement automatic voter registration, implement same-day or election-day registration, create expanded no-reason absentee voting for every citizen, and most recently create 9 days of early voting all across our state in every statewide election. So these have been really transformative in our state, but they've all been voter-driven, which makes them all the more stronger and more powerful to implement and to teach voters about, because many of them have weighed in on these policies, said they wanted them, and now we get to bring that to fruition on their behalf. And then in addition to that, the legislature, particularly over this last year, has enacted a whole slew of election policies that have really helped us get closer to achieving our goal of really ensuring the access and the security of the process. and being a leader in that nationwide. Among other things, we made it a crime. It's now a crime to threaten or harass election workers while on the job. We have expanded regulation of artificial intelligence in election communication, requiring disclosure of the use of artificial intelligence by candidates or campaigns, and banning the use of artificial intelligence to deceive voters. We have made it legal to give rides to the polls. Previously, it was not. We have implemented pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, so now they can pre-register and become registered automatically once they're turn 18. And we've also strengthened the laws to ensure canvassers certify election results efficiently and effectively in the post-election process. All of that has been in many ways reaction to both the ballot initiatives that citizens have enacted and the challenges that we faced over the last several years. And it's been great to see lawmakers come together and voters and really push for these changes and make them part of our laws.
And many of those changes, you know, they sound like pro-voter initiatives to make it easier to participate, but they're also sort of security measures in disguise, aren't they? Like, can you talk a little bit about how something like expanding early voting or some of the other laws you mentioned Michigan's passing hit the dual goals of access and integrity?
Yeah, that's such a great question, because so often we see these things framed as one or the other, when in reality, both good election administration and good election policy does both. It both expands access to the vote and ensures the security of the process. And a great example of that is automatic voter registration. The data shows that is one of the most significant changes or policy changes you can make to expand the number of eligible citizens who are registered to vote in any election. And at the same time, what we've seen in Michigan implementing automatic voter registration is that it also increases the accuracy of our voter rolls, because people are removed or their addresses are updated automatically if they are no longer eligible, or if they're not eligible at a previous address. So every time, for example, someone in our state renews a driver's license or interacts with my office, we essentially check their voter registration status, registering them if they're not registered, but affirming its accuracy if they're already registered. And that's, again, really helped us increase the accuracy and security of our voter rolls, which we know is of great importance for many people.
So if the Michigan legislature said, Secretary Benson, we will enact one election law of your choice, you get to decide one thing that we will promise to enact and the governor will sign to change Michigan elections, what law would that be?
We want to see a Michigan Voting Rights Act enacted in our state. This would expand and enhance the protections of the Federal Voting Rights Act, which is, you know quite well, have really been weakened over the last several years and stand to be weakened even more, given some cases that may get to the Supreme Court. And it's just under repeated attack. And so we believe every state needs to pass its own voting rights law to protect voters from intimidation and really accomplish a lot of the same goals of the federal law. Given the federal law's weakness and our opportunity in our states to create a strong protection.
And Nevada has one already, if you're looking among some other states, but Nevada had a Voting Rights Act, which was now part of the state constitution. The voters mm-hmm. enacted the change in the law was just to make what was statute now a part of their founding document. So there's some precedent for that, as well as some other voting rights acts around the country. So you are an elected official, and the nature of running for Secretary of State in Michigan is that it's a partisan race. So as an elected Democrat, how do you maintain nonpartisanship in the role of administering the state's elections?
Well, I often say democracy is a team sport, and secretaries of state play on that team as the referees, the nonpartisan referees who are obligated to facilitate free, fair, and accurate elections, and to educate and inform voters. As I wrote an entire book on how the role of a secretary of state is best performed when it's professional, when it's nonpartisan, and when it's transparent. And all the different ways in which we can do that really give rise to our ability to give people's faith in our elections and our ability as referees to guide them. And I'll say, as a sort of the other side of that is, what I found when I wrote my book on the office, interviewing every secretary of state in the country at the time, back in 2007 and 2008, was that no matter what format in which a secretary becomes their secretary, whether they're appointed or elected, really it all comes down, or even what party they're affiliated with, Democrat or Republican, just all comes down to the person. And it all comes down to whether the person serving in this role, regardless of how they get there or what party they're affiliated with, is truly dedicated to being a referee of elections and advancing things from a perspective of what's best for voters, not what's best for their party, or not what's best for any interest group they may represent. And it's been heartbreaking to see how many of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, particularly since 2020, in part, I would argue, because they want to be famous or they want to raise money or they want to run for another office, have abdicated their role as referees and instead chosen to be politicians instead. It's made it harder for the rest of us to do our jobs. But, you know, our goal is to set ourselves apart from those who decide to use their roles in partisan ways and instead demonstrate to the country that we can be nonpartisan, non-political referees of our elections. And indeed, that's what the job requires.
Yeah, I often point to you on the Democratic side and my Secretary of State in Kentucky, Michael Adams, who's also interviewing for this as someone on people on both sides who are doing that, you know, referee role. So I thank you for that. Are you optimistic about voting in elections with all the doom and gloom out there? Are you an optimist?
I am. You know, like you, those of us who've been doing this work for a number of decades, we have seen a real growth in attention on this work over the last couple of years. And that's been something that has really helped us become even stronger as a community. We see more people paying attention to democracy than ever before, more people participating in the process, certainly in Michigan and in other states, and more attention on the types of policies that actually yield the results we want, which are more accessible and more secure elections. So, you know, the story of democracy over the last several years has been one of great challenge, but it's also, if you read between the lines, it's been one of great growth. We've had high turnout. We've had more engagement than ever before. We have more people volunteering to be poll workers than ever before. And so all of that makes me feel that we can actually emerge from this moment with a healthier, more robust democracy than ever before, because more people are recognizing our role as Americans in protecting that democracy and how it will wither on the vine if we don't embrace that responsibility that we all have. I see more people embracing that responsibility than ever before. And despite, again, the challenges that have emerged as a result of the misinformation and politicians' actions over the last several years, the actions of citizens have been incredibly inspiring, as so many have stood in defense of our democracy and have gotten more involved, either as voters or as election workers or anything in between. And that gives me a lot of faith we're going to emerge from this with a healthier democracy than we did going into it.
So what's the one thing listeners can do to support civic engagement in democracy?
Yeah, I'll give you two things. I mean, one, certainly we need all citizens to be critical consumers of information. Fact check any information you have with nonpartisan sources. In Michigan, we have established a fact check website, michigan.gov/SOSFactCheck. We also encourage people to develop multiple sources of information and speak with trusted voices in your community and election officials when you have questions about your elections. And the second thing people should do is step up and serve as an election worker. There's no better way to see firsthand how secure and transparent our elections actually are than by serving as an election worker. And you get to fulfill your civic duty, help others vote and participate. It's really inspiring, if not long hours, but it's a great way to become an expert yourself in secure elections and do your part in helping to support democracy.
Jocelyn Benslin, Michigan Secretary of State, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist. This is a great conversation.
Thanks for having me. Good to see you.
This is Tom Martin. I'm here with Democracy Optimist host Josh Douglas. Josh, your expertise is in election law and voting. You're an election law and voting research professor at the University of Kentucky. So if you would give us the election law of the day.
You know, Tom, I'm always looking for positive news from states in ways in which we are making it easier to participate, easier to vote, breaking down barriers. And so today's election law of the day, I think I have to echo Secretary Benson with respect to Michigan's various voter reforms. You know, it was already beginning to become an innovator in creating an independent redistricting commission from the ground up, something we can talk about in just a minute. And over the past year, it's enacted a handful of new Michigan laws to ease voter registration, make it easier for people to get on the rolls, require 9 days of early voting, which is going to ease pressure on Election Day, especially when we saw so many long lines on Election Day previously. And then this last one, I think, is, you know, kind of technical, but really crucial. It passed a law to allow voters to fix clerical errors on their ballots. So, you know, you have a mail-in ballot, an absentee ballot. Perhaps you forgot to put the zip code on the outside envelope. The county clerks now will have to let you know that there's a clerical error and let you fix that mistake. You know, that's going to lead to much less disenfranchisement, many fewer votes being thrown out because the voter didn't follow the technical requirements. So those sorts of rules are not the most headline grabbing, but I think they'll have a tangible impact on voters.
You know, it's always good to have a good nugget of information in your hip pocket that you can pull out when you're in a conversation with somebody about the election. What sort of fun election fact can you share with us?
So in 2016, right after the election, a young woman in Michigan named Katie Fahey posted on Facebook, and she was sort of disillusioned about the election results. She was afraid of going to Thanksgiving dinner that year because, you know, many of her family members were staunch Donald Trump supporters, but other people in her family were big Bernie Sanders fans. And she was like, I don't know how I can handle Thanksgiving dinner. So she posted on Facebook and said, you know, hey, I'm thinking of taking on redistricting in Michigan. Anyone want to join in? And she sort of thought, okay, what's one issue that both sides hate, you know, except for the people in charge who are drawing the maps? You know, people from both ends and all ends of the political spectrum don't think it's fair when maps are rigged. So she put this on Facebook, expected a few people would respond and they'd go find an organization to help. Instead, the post blew up. People kept contacting her and saying, yes, I'm in. What do I do? And she was like, well, all these people are contacting me. So she ended up starting an organization, Voters Not Politicians, based on all of the people who contacted her. And they fought to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in Michigan in 2018 to create an independent redistricting commission. And they won. And so this election cycle, Michigan's going to be have elections with much fairer maps. Now, the map that the commission adopted is actually in litigation still, so we don't have a final outcome, but it's certainly a lot more fair than the entrenched politicians drawing the map. And as Katie told me, we basically overthrew the government. Now, peacefully, right? They did it at the ballot box by taking the power to draw maps away from the politicians and put it in the hands of this independent commission.
Well, what Katie did inspires this next question. And, you know, we're all so busy with our day-to-day. What is that one thing that each of us can do to support democracy?
So I recommend checking out the organization that Katie's Facebook post generated. It's called Voters Not Politicians. What a great name, right? Because it encapsulates what the whole point of this is, which is that our government is run by the voters, is the voters have primacy in our government, not the politicians who might be passing laws just to keep themselves in power. They were behind the push for an independent redistricting commission. They've also been behind the push for lots of other reforms in Michigan's election laws. And one thing I love about this organization is that it is truly nonpartisan. They have people from all walks of life, all political persuasions, all involved in the project of making our democracy stronger.
When we return in a moment, Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams.
You don't want to sense that one team is writing the rules and the other team is excluded, because what that leads to is a doubt about the election being fair in the first place, and a sense that people aren't being included. The whole point of elections is to include everybody and have every voice heard.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Democracy Optimist, an election year special series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. The exhibit Southern Women is on display through May 17th at Danville's Art Center of the Bluegrass. For more information, visit artcenterky.org. Allegro Dance Project in Lexington will conduct auditions February 24th. Registration begins at 3:30 p.m. For more information, visit allegrodanceproject.org. American acoustic supergroup Woodbox Heroes will perform February 25th at the Mountain Arts Center in Prestonsburg. For tickets and information, visit macarts.com. And the Leeds Theater in Winchester will present the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, February 23rd through 25th and March 1st through 3rd. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit leedscenter.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
We're back with Episode 1, Part 2 of our Election Year Special Series, Democracy Optimist. If you just joined us, our series is hosted by University of Kentucky Election Law and Voting Research Professor Joshua Douglas. His next guest, Kentucky Secretary of State Michael Adams.
Now, before we start, let me tell you a quick story about Secretary Adams. He and I initially met when he was running for his first term of office in 2019. And at some point that summer, he contacted me and said, hey, if I win, would you like to serve on my transition team to the office? I responded that I was pretty surprised, given that I opposed his number one campaign promise of enacting a strict photo ID requirement for Kentucky elections. His response? That's why I want you on my team. So I thought, maybe this guy's the real deal if he's looking for people who oppose his ideas to help him transition to the office. He won. I served on the transition team, and we can talk about in our conversation what the photo ID law in Kentucky did in addition to other Kentucky laws. Secretary Adams, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
So in an era in which partisanship seems to drive everything we talk about with respect to elections and voting rights, you have publicly strived for bipartisanship in the conversation about Kentucky election law. Why do you do that? And is it successful?
Well, it's certainly been successful here. I think it would succeed elsewhere if anybody else would have the good sense to try it. I think really any policy area, you ought to try to get as many voices together as you can. But I think especially with elections, it's really critical because you don't want to sense that one team is writing the rules and the other team is excluded. Because what that leads to is a doubt about the election being fair in the first place, in a sense that people aren't being included. The whole point of elections is to include everybody and have every voice heard. So what we found in Kentucky is when we have it formed in bipartisan fashion, when we get people in the room, a Democratic governor, Republican Secretary of State, legislators of both parties, county clerks of both parties, and we work in good faith to try to improve our system, number one, we just get a bigger array of voices and a better array of options for consideration. But also it's a good look. Because when we go out there and hold a press conference and explain our ideas jointly, it leads voters on both sides of the aisle and non-Democrats and Republicans too, independents, to feel like, well, look, this is a real fair system. My vote counts. I'm not going to be discriminated against. One team isn't conspiring to rig the election from the other team. We can trust this system. And I do think Kentucky is doing better than the average state right now in terms of public confidence in our elections. We have our challenges. I deal with that every day. But I do think that we're a lot better off here than what we see in some other states on that.
So let's talk about the myth-busting role of your job. You know, what's the biggest myth that many people believe regarding how our elections operate, and how do you combat that misinformation?
You know, the most frustrating thing about this job is dealing with misinformation. And the most frustrating thing about dealing with misinformation is every time you debunk a theory, those people retreat and they come back with another theory. And then they don't ever acknowledge that you just proved them 20 times before. They just act like it's a brand new conversation. So just to give you a couple of examples, back in 2020, when I worked with our Democratic governor to make sure we had a good election process during the worst of coronavirus. The predictions were that the Democrats were going to win all of these seats. They'd take legislative seats. Joe Biden might win Kentucky and all these predictions. Of course, they turned out to be pretty wildly off. Donald Trump won Kentucky by almost 30 points. Republicans picked up seats in the legislature. most voters who used early voting were registered Republican, actually, which was a shock to me, honestly, because the head of the Republican Party was saying that you can't trust early voting. So those people were debunked. And then they disappeared for a while, and they came back with a different theory, which was Adams and his ilk. They're not trying to steal elections for Democrats. They're trying to steal them for Rhino, mainstream, whatever you want to call them, centrist, traditional Republicans. And so then I started getting sued after the 2022 primaries in races that incumbent Republicans had won comfortably in their legislative races. Their challengers that had gotten blown out sued and alleged that we were rigging the elections for Republicans. And of course, they didn't acknowledge that we disproved those same theories 2 years before. So unfortunately, these theories, you know, the motives that are alleged changed, the methods changed. We've tried to be reasonably responsive. We never respond to any, we never concede any good faith on their part or any rightness, but we do try to take measures to cut them off of the past. For example, we passed a bipartisan ban on any of our ballot scanners from having internet capability. We passed that a couple of years ago. Not once in any Kentucky election has any voting equipment ever touched the internet. But I was pretty happy to write a law and say, well, we're going to ban it anyway, just so we can always debunk them and say, well, look, what they're saying that we're doing is against the law. It's a felony. No one's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, the response could be, well, so you need the law, so maybe you were doing it beforehand. You know, it's impossible to fight back against some of these things. I often say that, you know, no matter the number of times when my kids were younger and they would say, you know, there's monsters under the bed, you know, the number of times I look and tell them there's no monsters, it's proving a negative. You know, what more can I do besides look every single time and let them know there are still no monsters there? And that's sort of this idea of voter fraud, massive voter fraud, or you know, machines connected to the internet. It feels like that as well.
Yeah, you know, maybe a little beyond your question, but I think important is there is a larger social problem that we have today in our country, which is that there is such a doubt in institutions and a doubt in government that people will manufacture stuff that the government's doing to have something to be angry about and to be able to attack the government. And it's not just the elections, it's health officials. We see a lot of that. We've seen school boards under attack. We've seen health officials under attack, certainly the election community under attack. And when we debunk everything they say, these people respond that, well, you can't trust what Adam says. He's the deep state, he's the government. So it's sort of an ad hominem attack, and people who are inclined to believe that way, they're not really a receptive audience. They don't want to listen to facts. But my audience for these things that we do is not those people. They're a fringe. But there is a large, according to polling that we've seen, a large plurality of people that hear from one side and they hear from the other side. They hear the elections are great. They hear the elections are not great. And they don't know what to believe. And so it's my job to try to go to those people in the middle and convince them that we're in the right.
So let's talk about the rumor control section of the Secretary of State's website. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the point of that section of your website and what it tells voters.
Yeah, this has been really well received. This is something that's on our site. It's a Mythbusters site, and we take some of the things that are out there in social media and also things that people are asking legislators. Legislators frequently send me something they get from a constituent. Sometimes it's a legitimate question. Sometimes it's a false attack. But we do want to help them respond to their constituents and also respond to ours. And we take things out there that are said that are just totally false about how we count votes in Kentucky, about the role of the internet, about what unofficial results are versus official results, all of that stuff. And it's a little technical, but that's kind of the point that, yeah, we thought about this already. We thought about how do we ensure that we don't have hacking and we don't have fraud. And, you know, it's not like we walked in here and it never occurred to us that we'd have vulnerabilities. So we spot them and we deal with them. I've also found it's been helpful to literally Xerox copies of what's on our website and distribute it at events, at fairs and things like that, or the state fair where we have a booth, because we give out pens and, you know, swag, junk like that. It's also really important to get out information. And so this has been a good platform for us to reach the general public.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So you've talked a lot. You know, one of your slogans was, let's make it easier to vote and hard to cheat.
What we've shown in Kentucky is you can make it easy to vote and hard to cheat at the same time. You don't have to suppress voters. That's not right. You got to make this accessible for our people. It's good for both sides. It's good for the voters. But you also have to ensure security. Because again, if you don't, you're going to suppress voters because they're not going to trust your process and they're not going to come vote.
You've also discussed how laws that improve election security are also voter turnout measures. How do these two things coexist?
So I think both in policy and also in optics, you should do both. And I think right now in America today, you've got one party that prizes access, but sometimes has a little bit of a hard spot when it comes to security and integrity. You have the other party that's the opposite. They love integrity. They talk about it all the time, sometimes ad nauseum, and they're not always good on access. And I think it's important that you have both. You've got to have elections that have integrity. Number one, so that you have fair elections. Number two, so people will trust in them and actually will come vote. And that's good for access and turnout. And for the reason I said, it's good politically to balance the two. So you have both sides using the system, trusting the system. It's really important. In terms of the actual policy, I would say substantively that turnout, access, and security also work hand in hand. And let me give you an example. With early voting, I think that's maybe the capstone of what we've accomplished here is to expand our voting to beyond one day, which is just, you know, we had one day to vote since 1891. And it just doesn't reflect how people live their lives in modern day America. There's no other government function that we just make available for one day. It's pretty crazy. So we've expanded that out. One of my goals for my second term is to see a higher utilization of early voting. But one argument that I made, not just in the legislature to get Republicans to vote for early voting, but also have made since then to get voters just trusted and to utilize it, is early voting isn't just good for access. It obviously is. It's also good for security because election day is pretty chaotic. You've got potentially millions of voters showing up, voting, lines, poll workers kind of frazzled. If you can smooth that out over a few days, you make it a smoother experience for poll workers. They're going to be more attentive to checking the identity of who is voting, of making sure there's not been any sort of tampering, that sort of thing. When you have a smooth election, you have a better election, a more trustworthy election. So I don't think expanding access hurts security. There is an effort right now in the legislature to repeal early voting. And I will say this, obviously I'm against it, but at least the people that are pushing it are not arguing that we've got fraud in our elections because of early voting. They're making other arguments I don't agree with, but at least they're not going there. And I think that tells you a lot about Kentucky today, how we've not been as gullible to misinformation as some other states.
Yeah, of course, I would like to see an expansion of early voting, at least for the urban areas. You know, maybe 3 days makes sense for some of the rural counties, perhaps not in the urban areas. In addition, I would add, expanding our poll closing time. You know, we're one of the earliest in the country closing our polls at 6 p.m., and so I think, you know, a lot of people are not off work by then. If they do want to go on that Tuesday, it makes it pretty difficult to show up.
Yeah, I personally think if you have to pick one of the two, and you don't, but if you did have to pick one of the two, adding other days or other hours outside of more than 12 hours on one day is a better way to do that. It's easier to get poll workers for shorter periods of time, like an 8-hour day versus a 12 plus hour day. Ironically, when I first ran for this job, I visited as many county clerks as I could when I was campaigning of both parties, and I asked them, how do you feel about early voting? And they were all against it. And now they all support it because it actually makes their job easier. I do sense some appetite among some of the counties to expand to more voting days. I do think if we do that, it does need to be uniform, even though I do think that some counties would benefit more than other counties from more days to vote. I just don't want the idea of having more days to vote in one county versus another. I think there's an equal protection issue there. I think it's very feasible that we'll have more voting days in the relatively near future, maybe during my term. But I think first we have to see a higher usage of our existing early voting days. Right now, it's a tough sell for me with the legislature to have more than three extra days because even with a real push from our office and a push from the Beshear and Cameron campaigns last fall, we still had just under 20% of voters using the early voting. What you see in other states, we've looked, Tennessee, West Virginia, Ohio, states that have had early voting for years, is when they first enacted it, it took a few cycles for it to really catch on. But once it did, about half the vote got cast early and about half on election day. And that's led to a much, much smoother process for the voters and for the poll workers and election officials.
Yeah, that makes a big difference. What's your biggest fear about the 2024 election and how are you preparing?
I actually just about an hour ago finished a podcast with the Washington Post, and they asked me that same question. And I said, I know there's a lot of concern on a lot of fronts, and I share that. But actually what keeps me up at night, relatively speaking, is the more typical blocking and tackling things that we have to do in terms of getting enough poll workers and enough locations. And those are two separate issues, and I'll tell those a little bit. When I was elected in 2019, I was asked to come testify to the legislature. Before I was even sworn in, I was telling them, we have a poll worker crisis brewing. We have fewer and fewer people who are re-enlisting, and younger generations are not enlisting at all. And I said that in 2019, before COVID, before 2020, before threats of violence in the election process, and none of that's helped. So number one, we do have always a challenge with getting poll workers. It's better than I thought it would be, but we still have our work cut out for us. We have raised the pay. I say we, it's not me, it's the county clerks, the local governments, doubled or even tripled the pay. That's really helped stanch some of the bleeding of our recruitment, but we still have a long way to go there. The other challenge is having enough locations. That's gotten much, much harder. I would say getting locations is harder than getting poll workers for a couple of reasons. One is schools are less apt to play ball, especially coming out of COVID. They've been closed for a long time. Parents put immense pressure on the school boards to not close the schools for anything, including voting. And so there was pushback on our efforts to use the schools. Some of the schools are worried about security. They're worried about letting the general public on the premises, especially if kids are there. But even if they're not there, they're worried about acts of violence. They're worried about some person coming onto the premises, scoping the place out, and then becoming an active shooter later. They have real security concerns. Churches, too, we've seen a decline in churches volunteering. We've historically had a lot of churches join us as voting locations. 2022 wasn't good for that either, because we had an abortion amendment on the ballot here, and we have pro-choice churches like the Unitarians, we have pro-life churches like the Catholic churches, and a lot of those churches had some literature out there on their premises for or against the amendment, and so some voters got bent out of shape about that because they had strong views on the other side. So some of the churches said, we're done. Everything's political now. We can't do this anymore. It takes about... in theory, about 3,800 places in Kentucky, that's how many precincts we have, 3,800 physical locations for us to open all the precincts, which we don't do now. But if we did, that's what it would take. I don't have 3,800 buildings under my purview. This is a tiny office. I can't commandeer buildings. And the vast majority of the buildings that are used are not public buildings in the first place. They're private buildings. So persuading them to volunteer their premises is getting harder and harder. And you know, there's an overlap with the reasons people don't want to be poll workers. They also don't want to give up their premises, not knowing what could happen.
Yeah. So lots to consider as we get ready for the 2024 election. Secretary Adams, here's my last question. Are you optimistic? You know, this show is called Democracy Optimist. Are you optimistic about voting, elections, and democracy as we enter the presidential election year?
I'm going to give you some cautious optimism, and here's where that comes from. I got a lot of surprises the last 4 years. The stuff I expected in 2019 and then my actual experience since then, nothing close to each other. But here's some sunny optimism, and I'm really sincere about this. I am shocked still to this day how much people actually do listen to legitimate sources of information when they're making decisions. And here's an example. In early 2020, April of 2020, when I worked out an arrangement with Governor Beshear for how we were going to run the elections during COVID, there was a poll. It wasn't my poll, but there was a poll done that showed that by 3 or 4 or 5 to 1, Democrats approved of it, independents approved of it, and Republicans opposed it 2 to 1. They opposed absentee voting in a pandemic before we even knew what transmitted coronavirus, before masking, before vaccines, when we just didn't know anything. They were still against people being able to safely vote at home and against early voting as well. But we went out there, our office, we did a media blitz. We conveyed information all day, every day about why you can trust absentee voting, why you can trust early voting, why this is good for you, why you can trust it. And when people voted 2 months later, not only did Republican voters believe us and accept what we did, they actually utilized it. They used the early voting. They used the absentee voting. And if they hadn't, if we had not been able to convince them that they could trust it, even though the leader of the Republican Party was saying you can't, if we had not been successful, the election would have crashed, because the election relied on not just changing stuff, but people taking advantage of those changes and actually voting absentee and voting early. So I'll confess, I've been in politics a long time. I can be a little cynical sometimes. That really taught me something, which is people will listen. Even people that you think are maybe not willing to hear you out and won't take the word of some mid-level official over a sitting president, they actually will listen if you address their concerns. Don't stereotype them. Listen to them, address them in good faith, and explain not just why it's okay, but why they should use it.
Yeah, well, hopefully conversations like these will help to sustain people's feelings toward what's possible for democracy this year.
Yeah.
Secretary of State Michael Adams, the Secretary of State of Kentucky, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
My pleasure.
This is Tom Martin here with Democracy Optimist host Josh Douglas. Josh, you live and breathe election law and voting. So I'm wondering, what would be your election law of the day?
So we mentioned at the beginning of our conversation with Secretary Adams, Kentucky's voter ID law, which was his number one campaign promise. And I worked with him on crafting a law that I have called in my scholarship one of the mildest forms of photo ID in the country. And why is it mild? Because there's lots of different kinds of IDs that count, as well as a fail-safe mechanism for voters who show up to the polls and don't have an ID. In Kentucky, if you show up to the polls without a photo ID, so long as you show a non-photo ID, you know, credit card, social security card, something like that, and you fill out an affidavit saying, you know, you are who you say you are, then you can vote a regular ballot just like everybody else. That's different from a lot of other states that if you show up without an ID, you have to fill out a provisional ballot, which will not count unless you take additional steps after Election Day. But I do want to dispel some myths about photo ID laws. Even though the Kentucky model is pretty good in terms of not disenfranchising very many people because of all of the fail-safe mechanisms we put into the law, I hear arguments all the time that you need a photo ID to vote just like you need a photo ID to board a plane or to buy Sudafed. And that's just simply not true. In fact, a couple weeks ago, I mistakenly showed up to the airport without my driver's license. I put it aside and forgot to put it back in my wallet. And I was able to get through security just fine. It took a couple extra minutes, a much more thorough security process. They went through all of my stuff. But I was able to get through airport security just fine. With respect to you need an ID to buy Sudafed, well, you actually don't. Pharmacists have workarounds if you go to buy it and you don't have an ID. Of course, neither are fundamental rights of living in a democracy either. So I think photo ID laws, it's, you know, a big hot button issue. They cause more harm than good. The Kentucky model is a reasonable solution if we're going to have one. But we should also make sure we have the truth about what photo IDs do and whether you need them or not. Not to mention, by the way, the only kind of fraud that a photo ID law would prevent is in-person impersonation, and that simply doesn't happen.
Okay, let's say we're hanging out with friends, or maybe it's dinner with family, and we're having this great conversation about this election coming up, and we want to be on top of things. And the way to do that is to have a really great fact in your hip pocket. Could you give us a fun election fact that we can wow our friends and family with?
So this episode, we were focusing on Kentucky specifically, and I was proud to learn that Kentucky was historically an innovator in election reform. It was the first state to pass a statewide women's suffrage law in 1838, letting female heads of households vote in elections on tax and local school boards. In addition, Kentucky was the second state after Georgia to lower the voting age from 21 to 18 for state elections, doing so in 1955, 16 years before the federal constitutional amendment that lowered the voting age to 18 for all elections. So on various aspects of expanding suffrage, Kentucky has been at the forefront.
I think the possibility of an erosion of democracy that has been the norm in this country for centuries is motivating a lot of people to become active in some way. What one thing can we do to support democracy?
Visit your state's voter registration site right now to check your voter registration. Too often people wait until the last minute to check their voter registration. I check mine every year just because, just to make sure that there's nothing going on, that there hasn't been a mistake in my voter registration. In Kentucky, the voter registration deadline is 29 days before the election. And, you know, a lot of people are not paying attention a month out. Of course, I am, but I do this, you know, for a living. I focus on voting rights and election law. In Kentucky, you can go to govote.ky.gov, and that will take you to the voter registration site. Every state has a site where you can check your voter registration. So I encourage people to look at the beginning of the year, make sure you're good to go, and then get a friend to do so as well. Send a link to the voter registration website to your friend or family member and say, hey, it takes 2 minutes, check your voter registration just to make sure.
On the next episode of Democracy Optimist, we bring the 2024 election season down to where we live.
So it's really going to take people looking at our civic life nationally and saying, I think we can do better, and I think I can do better in my community, and looking for ways to do that.
Richard Young, Executive Director of CivicLex.
It's the most impactful. It's the level that's closest to you. It's the level which people have the most hope and haven't gotten jaded on like they have on national politics. And it's the level that it's the easiest to impact.
And you'll hear from two of the local officials who are on the front lines of voting, Fayette County Clerk Susan Lamb and Madison County Clerk Kenny Barger. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Joshua Douglas, our writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer, me, Tom Martin, producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Special appreciation to Madeline Peru for our theme music, American. Mason Graber, research assistant, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. This series is online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available wherever you get podcasts. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.